war, revealing corruption problems at every level within Ukraine society, the 27-nation bloc continues to send billions of euro to the country. Massive amounts of deadly Western arms arrive into Ukraine every day. EU leaders are due to hold a summit this Thursday and Friday here in the Belgian capital. The war in Ukraine will dominate proceedings. If previous summits are anything to go by, do not expect a single reference to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Muslims have arrived at Mount Arafat to perform one of the final rituals of this year's Hajj pilgrimage. It is on this day that pilgrims spend the day praying, reciting the Quran, and repenting until sunset. The day is called Arafah, and the act is known as Wuquf.
Yes, I pray for all Muslims that may Allah grant them.
The significance of this place is that it was here that the Holy Prophet of Islam delivered his last sermon. He called on Muslims to uphold human dignity, respect women's rights, uphold economic equality, avoid discrimination, and be faithful to the teachings of Islam.
Muslims should unite. Islamic unity is a necessity, but unfortunately, Muslims have different views.
Another event that takes place on Arafah is called the Disavowal of Polytheists. Pilgrims took part in this ceremony in which a message by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was read out.
The political aspect of the Hajj is even more important than its spiritual aspect.
The two main points of the message were unity and spirituality. He called on Muslims to use the opportunity of Hajj to get to know each other and strengthen ties in all aspects. He also pointed out that the West, specifically the US and Israel, are against the unity of Muslims.
All the actions and rituals performed by the pilgrims are all intended to show Muslim unity, equality, and spiritual revelation, among other things. Lahi Tahami, Mount Arafat.
A better future for digital economy. This is what the 26th edition of the International Electronic Computer and E-commerce Exhibition, dubbed ELECOMP, promises its visitors this year. After a hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic, state-of-the-art electronic technologies are once again on display in Tehran, offering a glimpse at what the country has to offer in this field, particularly with the activities of knowledge-based companies gaining momentum over the past couple of years.
This is a corridor presenting all the knowledge-based products of Iran. There are more than 1,200 knowledge-based high-tech products presented in 15 different sections here. It is actually a favorable place to visit for foreign delegations traveling to Iran.
This is in line with the current administration's short and midterm plans for the digital economy to thrive. The exhibition is also laying the groundwork for a forum of ICT ministers of eco-countries to be held next month in Tehran.
Regional countries are the main customers of our products. We have managed to gain a foothold in Azerbaijan, Armenia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. That is because we offer the latest technology at a reasonable price.
Over 450 domestic and 50 foreign companies are present, offering their latest services and sharing their experiences in workshops held on the sidelines of the exhibition.
We have that digital tools available in the market that are not available here, so we think that that could be beneficial for Iranian companies to use our resources, and we think that we can use the resources Iranian companies have, like their skills in a digital marketplace, the market size, and all that stuff.
I didn't know that startup scene here is so is going in good way. We've been in Paradise Technology Park. There is incubators, accelerators. I didn't have idea about that. We are also doing the same things. We can connect on these ideas together, looking for investors, VC funds, and startups, and make some good unicorns.
We believe that communication by our countries will be great, will be growth, and we will be nearly than in the past.
Elecomp is the greatest commercial event in Iran's market of electronics and computer products and services. Since its first edition in 1995, it has been providing a unique opportunity for businesses active in this sector to grow.
As far as the Islamic Republic of Iran is concerned, digital economy is high on the agenda. In a forum of ICT ministers of the member states of the Economic Cooperation Organization, in Tehran, an infrastructure will be set up for the member states to make use of the capacities that are available. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
As polls had largely predicted, the leader of the center-right party New Democracy, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, emerged as the big winner of the repeat elections held in Greece on Sunday after securing a landslide victory on May 21st elections, when the leader of the left-leaning party Syriza was left 20 percentage points behind. Mitsotakis swept once again the parliamentary elections, obtaining over 40% of Sunday's ballot. In the May 21st elections, under a proportional electoral law, the New Democracy leader didn't gather enough votes to win an outright majority. This time, thanks to new election rules, Mitsotakis has been rewarded with a bonus of up to 50 seats, which grants him an absolute majority in the 300-seat Greek parliament.
Με το σημερινό εκλογικό αποτέλεσμα...
For the second time in just a few weeks, the citizens have not only told us to continue on the path we set 4 years ago, but they have told us to move faster because the country needs it. Greece is opening a new historic chapter.
During his first term as Prime Minister, Mitsotakis was accused of orchestrating mass wiretaps of lawmakers and journalists and came under heavy criticism following a deadly train accident last February. Recently, he has also been attacked by opposition politicians and members of non-governmental organizations over the handling of the sinking of a trawler carrying as many as 750 migrants in the Mediterranean, in which hundreds of people are believed to have drowned.
Right or left, whoever wins, it makes no difference for the Greek people. It must be clear that Greece's present and future are in the hands of the European Commission.
Mitsotakis has so far pushed forward a large privatization program, which has included the sale of public assets and crucial infrastructures, and cut spending policies on public services, which have resulted in a further welfare retrenchment.
The biggest problem of Greece is the economical problem. The country needs new jobs, a lot of new jobs.
Also this time, the participation rate in Greece's elections only reached 60%, one of the lowest levels ever recorded in the country since it became a republic in 1974. Mitsotakis will soon be given an exploratory mandate to form a government by Greek President Katerina Sakellaropoulou. After years of financial crisis, Mitsotakis' biggest challenge will be turning Greece into a real player in the European Union, without leaving too many Greeks behind. Max Civili, Athens.
Spectacular geological site of outstanding natural beauty lies within the limits of the Aras River to the north and the southern end of the Lesser Caucasus mountain range. Designated by the UNESCO, Aras Geopark enjoys a range of climates as well as rich geodiversity and biodiversity while linking different cultures on the northern and southern sides of the mountain chain.
As of today, I extend my invitation to anyone from across the world who loves our planet and who wants to learn more about the geologic history of Earth to visit this spectacular heritage where 400 million years of evolution is documented.
Definitely a cause for celebration. The recent UNESCO designation is the result of decades of hard work by Iranian experts and officials on both a local and national level.
In 1995, a group of experts, including myself, started working on the dossier to present it to UNESCO. There were many ups and downs, but eventually, with the support of all managers of Aras Free Zone organization, throughout these years, the region was finally designated as a UNESCO geopark.
located in Iran's East Azerbaijan province at Asgeo Park, covers an area of about 1,670 square kilometers. The highest point being Mount Kiamaki and Julfa, arching over 3,347 meters into the sky, and the lowest, the Aras River Valley. This is definitely a geotourism attraction with a diverse tectonic structure, flora and fauna.
At Aras Free Zone Organization, we managed to follow up this dossier and it led to this achievement. But let's not forget that this is only the beginning. There's still a lot that needs to be done.
400 million years of the history of the Earth is summed up in this region, making a perfect destination for scientists and researchers.
The UNESCO Global Geopark designation was created in 2015 and recognizes geological heritage of international significance. The recent designation of Aras Geopark brings the total up to 195 sites, covering a surface area of about 486,000 square kilometers worldwide.
The UNESCO designation of Aras Geopark is considered a turning point, not just because it can act as a magnet for tourists, but also because it raises awareness about sites and landscapes of international geological significance. Kisumish Ahmadi, Aras.
Archmond, Ahmed Ghulamifard and Hosseini Mofred arrive in court in The Hague having travelled from Iran to seek justice. A fifth Iranian man, Ghadir Jafari, is also part of the campaign but couldn't attend due to ill health. The former soldiers say two Dutch firms supplied chemicals to Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and the Iraqi dictator used these to create and deploy deadly mustard gas.
In December 1986, I was exposed to a gas attack. My lungs are burned. I have problems with my respiratory system.
The men's lawyers are in no doubt that Dutch firms Malkomi and KBS Holland are culpable.
The mustard gas produced in those years and up until 86 can only have been produced with their chemicals. And so we say the victims that fell in that period, some of whom are here today, must have been, it can't be different, must have been injured by the chemicals of this Dutch company.
The regime of Western-backed Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein killed and severely injured tens of thousands of Iranians during the 1980 to 1988 war, often using chemical weapons. Experts say mustard gas kills slowly from the inside out.
It basically burns the whole lung. And it also damages eye and skin, immune system. It can cause cancer.
Those seeking justice say their main aim is to save others from ever going through their agony.
I want my voice to be heard so that no one else in the world will use chemical weapons again like they did against us. The world needs tougher regulations to prevent development, production and use of these weapons.
The Dutch firms being sued by survivors claim the chemicals they supplied to Iraq were intended for agricultural pesticide use only. Having listened to a full day of complex evidence, the three judges presiding over this case in the district court ruled that a verdict will be delivered on the 23rd of August. Jerome Hughes, The Hague.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Thank you.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iraq's attack on Iran in the 1980s killed many Iranians with the help of Western-supplied military equipment. The Sardasht chemical attack, which occurred 36 years ago, in which the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was responsible for the killing of some 130 Iranians, may be a piece of history, but the survivors who are suffering until this day deserve justice and have not forgotten this brutal attack. The guilty ones, namely the U.S., France, the U.K., and Netherlands, as concluded by the ICJ, have not been held accountable either. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why countries who preach human rights are guilty of committing the most heinous crimes, like the ones involving the use of chemical weapons. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Christopher Halali, researcher and political analyst, joins us from Verchar, Vermont. Also joining us, Tony Gosling, historian, investigative journalist who joins us from Bristol. Welcome to you both. Let me start with you, Tony Gosling, first, if I may. Tony Gosling, tell us, I'm going to use your researcher skills and put it to the test and ask you about what you remember of this incident that happened 36 years ago in Sardasht. Or, if not, then what you would stands out in your mind when it comes to the use of chemical weapons during the eight-year imposed war on Iran?
Well, look, chemical weapons, I'm afraid, are completely normal when it comes. Just look at the Vietnam War and the use of the defoliants, the destruction of the ability of the Vietnamese to grow food. That was all just sprayed. Poison was sprayed across forests, across crops, whenever the Americans felt like it. So I don't think it's actually at all fair to even put a principle that the United States may not use chemical weapons. They do it all the time, and they've been doing it right from the start. Because when they decided that they wanted, after the Suez, to take over from the British as one of the main world empires after World War II, they did it in a very, very different fashion. The British Trojan horse was to do with God and Christianity, and they would come with missionaries to persuade people. The Americans really didn't have anything other than the gun, the bomb, and poison in order to intimidate people to come into their empire. So it was a very different character. I think some would say just as bad in many ways, but the Iran-Contra scandal, I think, is the most important thing to tease out of this relationship with Nicaragua. And I mean, for me at the time watching this, it was amazing to see it emerge in the 1980s and 90s as this incredible... Basically, what had happened was the Americans wanted to destroy Nicaragua and other countries around the world, bring them into their empire, but the politicians wouldn't let them. Congress and the House of Representatives wouldn't vote through the money that they needed to destroy these countries and to attack them. And so what they decided to do is set up an enormous multi-billion dollar slush fund led by the military and by the intelligence service, the CIA, and other criminal elements, including the mafia and the gangsters. And this organization then went around selling drugs and buying weapons and putting in people like the Contras, which are these far-right paramilitaries, mercenaries, in order to destabilize governments. And none of this was officially part of U.S. policy, but it was all going on. They were trying to pretend that it wasn't happening, pretend, keep it secret, a little bit like, you know, the Israelis do with their nuclear weapons. Let's pretend the world doesn't know we're doing this. Well, anyway, even if the Western public didn't know it was happening, certainly many people in the victim countries knew it was going on, and certainly their intelligence services and their governments knew. So that, for me, is the big takeaway with the Daniel Ortega and Nicaragua, was the link to this, the setting up of these enormous organizations, criminal, mercenary, killer organizations that would provide the money that was necessary for what the American government was not prepared to vote through. Of course, that very few, if any, of these people were ever convicted of the crimes that they committed, the international crimes they committed. In fact, I think it was George Bush Sr. gave them all pardons when he was president. So, you can see there's this kind of unofficial foreign policy that was being forced on countries like this. And, of course, it completely breaks international law.
All right. Let me bring in Christopher Hilali into the conversation. Christopher Hilali, welcome. We're looking at 36 years since that horrible incident that happened in Sardasht. I'd like to find out from you, obviously, your initial thoughts, but more so if you can give us a depth as to the how violent and cruel a decision was made by the U.S. in terms, and other countries I should mention, like the U.K. and France, to have provided these types of weapons, chemical weapons, to Iraq with the intent. I mean, they didn't pull the trigger, but they provided the ammunition for it, so to speak. So give us your thoughts on this, if you can.
Of course. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that the United States, the United Kingdom, and many other partners at that time of Iraq, of Saddam Hussein's government, are liable and have blood on their hands. They are war criminals for the weapons that they gave to the Iraqi army to use against civilians and in combat against Iran in an unprovoked and violent war of aggression. And so one thing to understand is that, you know, if we look at the history, it's very humorous to me that, you know, all those years later, when America said that, you know, we have to go to war, Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, all they had to do was open up the Pentagon and look for the receipts, and they would see that they were the ones that had provided these chemical weapons, which are, in international law, weapons of mass destruction. The lives, the amount of people who were not only killed and murdered by these weapons, but also maimed and wounded. And so I think that, you know, there's certainly a lot here in terms of history. And the Iranian people have not forgotten that, and nor should they, because they recognize who supported Saddam Hussein in his aggression against the Islamic Republic and against Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution and the revolution of the masses for justice. So I think, you know, if we're looking at it in the broad scale of time, you know, how many people have suffered and what a just outcome is, it's to see a lot of those war criminals up on trial for what they have done. And not only here, but, you know, as I heard coming into the program, for what they did in Latin America, connecting the struggles, because a lot of the financing, a lot of the weaponry, was done at a period of time when a lot of oppressed peoples were fighting for their liberation against imperialism, and the U.S. was supporting any group that they could, legally and illegally and covertly, to have their aims.
All right. Let me ask you another thing here, Christopher Hilali, if I may, that shows the depth of knowledge that the U.S. had, because the U.S. has said in its own defense that it did not know that Saddam Hussein was going to use these chemical weapons, even though the U.S. had provided it with these chemical weapons, that it didn't know that it was going to launch some kind of chemical attack. But you have the CIA files proving that the U.S. was responsible. Not only that, you have, and this is just based on a search that anyone can really get, where a retired Air Force colonel who was a military attaché in Baghdad during the 1980s, who has said that the Iraqis, quote, never told us that they intended to use nerve gas. They didn't have to. We already knew that they would. So that's proof in itself that the U.S. was aware that Iraq was, and its, I guess Saddam Hussein, were going to go through with this.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. And don't forget, the U.S. government knew that Saddam Hussein was a thug and that Saddam Hussein was a gangster of a type. And so they wanted him to play that role. And Saddam Hussein played off the United States and the Soviet Union against each other through him. And so he would do dealings and you know, do what he could to get concessions out of both. And of course, with the U.S. side, they were fully aware of what he was doing domestically, and they were aware of his expansionist plans. But that aligned with what the United States wanted, which was to see Ayatollah Khomeini brought down, the Islamic Republic brought down. Don't forget, they had just suffered. You remember the speech of Jimmy Carter, you know, Iran is this island of stability, you know, in a more troubled area. Well, that trouble was the Iranian people rising up against the U.S.-backed Shah. And so once that happened, and once the people, you know, wanted Khomeini, wanted the Islamic Revolution, what ended up happening? The U.S. felt that it had a huge loss, you know, similar to that in Vietnam. They had lost this fifth largest army. They had put all this money into Iran, which was now in the hands of the revolution and the weaponry and the technology. And so they felt that they wanted payback. And the payback was giving Saddam anything Saddam wanted and his government wanted to ensure that they could do that. They knew fully well, Brzezinski, all of the military brass, all of the top diplomats, they knew, and they write it in their own writings. And what they wanted was for both sides to kill each other, but more so for Iranians to spill their blood, because they had to pay for making America look weak and look bad. And they knew. They knew. The lieutenant colonel, the Air Force commander you were speaking about, it's well known. They didn't have weapons to a gangster with the idea that he's just going to keep it and just say, oh, I have it in case. No, of course he's going to use it. And they knew full well that he was going to use it. They knew full well he was going to use it throughout the conflict. And he did. And so that shows, and the CIA documents prove it, State Department, cables and everything, it all proves that the United States is culpable and morally responsible and should be held in international law because of that, of those chemical weapons, and because it knew that there was a deliberate intent to use those weapons against Iranian people, including civilians.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Tony Gosling, taking a look at that time and taking that piece of history and basically trying to make sure that this is not shelved, we're taking a look not just at that incident that happened 36 years ago, but overall taking a look at that period where the Iraqi imposed war on Iran was executed. There were more than 30 chemical attacks against Iranian non-military targets from what I'm reading here. And it's not just the U.S. that was involved. The U.K., also France, and also the Netherlands, where they provided these chemical weapons. What type of thinking was there in those countries to go ahead with this type of mentality and approach? Now, one of the things that I'm going to say, based on the research done, was that it was because, in terms of Iran's military edge, it was gaining ground against Iraq. And the U.S. figured this would be a way, though they didn't say that outright, obviously. The CIA files revealed that. But what's your take on that type of approach, using chemical weapons in a theater of war?
Well, that's right. This sort of warfare is, it's a very dangerous thing to be doing. But you know what? It's extremely convenient for the West. And I'll tell you a little anecdote, because I was working in Bristol in the CREATE Center, which is a big open plan office, back in the 1990s. And just at the coffee machine, I was just talking about what was going on in the Middle East. And the guy who was running a business just opposite me said, well, you know, we supplied, and he was talking about his business, supplied the precursor chemicals to Iraq to make the chemical weapons with. So that's how, I mean, it wasn't, and people who were, I think, involved in Britain were, Not they weren't actually complicit in the crimes, but they felt bad about what they realized afterwards these chemicals could have been used for. So they were being told that this was for an innocuous purpose of some sort. And yet someone somewhere within the British military, or even outside the military, it could be just simply a private military operation of some sort. Almost certainly, though, of course, with the sanction of the Crown and maybe the Joint Chiefs, for example, in the States, or the Joint Forces in Britain, were supplying these. So, I mean, this is just literally from being in Bristol in the 1990s. I picked up this information from, and you know, he was saying, well, you know, it was us. You know, we were involved in all this, and of course, the reason is one of the purposes here is that the British and the Americans get to test these weapons without actually getting their hands dirty. So they're giving them to somebody else. They're manipulating Saddam, in this case, into thinking that he's going to make he's going to be able to keep it all secret. He's going to be able to make some kind of war winning opportunity using these chemical weapons, but that no one will find out that they ever came from Britain. Well, this is the trouble, of course, with much of this Western policy, is that they're doing it on the assumption of secrecy. Now, look, we're living in the internet age. We were in the 1990s too. And what happens is people either Maybe this is one of the reasons they want to bring in artificial intelligence into targeting, as they're doing in Ukraine, is because the artificial intelligence may well tell no tales. What happens is when human individuals are involved in these atrocities and breaking international law, they have a guilty conscience, many of them anyway, or most of them have a conscience, and they think to themselves, well, afterwards, that wasn't the right thing to do. And if some investigator comes along and asks them, even if it's just many years after, were you involved in this, they may be very happy to talk about it, to get it off their conscience. And so I can tell you almost certainly the precursors for those chemical weapons probably came from Bristol in England, and if there was an investigation, you may even find where exactly they were made. But that's why they do it. They want to test these weapons out, and they also want to dirty the hands of people who, you know, like it's like the shaking hand of Tony Blair. When he comes and shakes your hand, that means that you're for the scaffold. That means you're about to be executed, and you're going to be let go. And they've been manipulating smaller countries like that for many years, trying to bring them into their confidence and then destroying them.
All right. Piece of fact coming out of that imposed war in Iran, I'd like to break it up a little bit more with you, Christopher Hilali. It was reported that the United States learned through satellite imagery at the time that Iran was about to gain a major strategic advantage on the ground over the Iraqi forces, and at that time, U.S. Intelligence officials, they actually conveyed the locations of the Iranian troops to Iraq, fully aware that Saddam Hussein's military was going to use these chemical weapons, which included sarin, based on the report that we have, which is a lethal nerve agent. I'd like to find out from you, when you have that type of approach by the U.S., how that is actually then repeated when it comes to the Iraq War 1 and 2, when it comes to other theaters of war that the U.S. has been involved in, and also most recently where the U.S. Was contemplating giving approval for depleted uranium to Ukraine to be used in the, from the tanks that they have. Why is it that the U.S. feels like it has to subscribe to chemical weapons or even depleted uranium, which they used in the Iraq War also, in order to achieve their so-called goals?
Absolutely, it must be stated, without a doubt, that the United States not only provides intelligence, as you mentioned, satellite imagery, troop movements, and locations for where, there are buildups of forces from the quote-unquote enemy that they provide to their local forces on the ground, be it, in this case, to Saddam's army, or whether it be in Yugoslavia or even contemporary, giving locations of Russian positions to Ukrainians to use the HIMARS and other artillery that they have and their drones and airstrikes to target Russian forces. So this is known throughout, recent history that the United States does this. It's part of their warfighting strategy, is to give this important intelligence to the armies carrying out their wills. And that's what really makes these wars proxy wars, but even more so now, because of the armaments and things like that, much more dangerous and higher level than even proxy wars. In going back to Iraq the Iraqi imposed war on Iran, Iranians had the advantage at one point in the war, and actually quite a few points in the war, but especially because this was an unprovoked war on the Iranian people, on the Iranian nation. And so the willpower to fight back. And of course, the United States tried to create, stoke sectarianism, ethnic tensions, religious tensions, down in Bandar Abbas, where you have a lot of Arabs who many of them are Sunni. Of course, you have in the reports, they're going to be natural allies of the Ba'athist army because Saddam is, Arab, he's Sunni. And so, but that didn't happen. In fact, the opposite happened. They were loyal and patriotic, and they believed that this was an attack on the entire Iranian nation. And so they fought even harder to preserve the nation. And so, of course, with this advantage, the United States gave a lot of the locations, a lot of the troop movements to the Iraqi military with state-of-the-art technology in order for Iraq not only to target those forces, But as the previous colleague here mentioned, to use and to test these chemical weapons and to see their accuracy, to see their potency and their lethality. And so they had all that data. That data came off the ground and went into the reports, many of them top secret, many of them we'll never see. But they're there, and they knew that this was going to happen, and they wanted it to happen. We know that this war imposed on Iran was meant to dislodge the Islamic Revolution because it was such a profound threat to the United States and to its regional partners. And so, of course, with this in mind, there's full knowledge of what was going to transpire.
Okay.
And it should be stated again that the United States has done this and continues to do it and will do it into the future, providing locations, providing geospatial imagery, satellite imagery, everything like that to ensure that its forces or its proxies have the advantage in fighting. And of course, in using these kinds of weapons. The depleted uranium was used throughout the previous decades. And that, of course, has caused long-term damage and health defects and environmental damage. And they knew that.
And the images that we've been showing in this program are testament to not only the brutality and the side effects that these unfortunate victims suffered during that time, but how this has been now passed on generation after generation. Yet the U.S. still keeps the sanctions, Tony Gosling, in place to this day, where there are people who are still suffering here inside of Iran. Why doesn't the U.S. get some relief in that way for Iranians who are suffering from this brutal event that took place, of which so many people actually not only died from it, but to this day are suffering from it?
Well, I think it's because it's suffering from a brutal meltdown in internal democracy. And what you ended up with is a criminal clique that the last thing they want to do is to admit their many, many sins and faults. That's why they won't get rid of these sanctions. And unless there is a complete shift in government in the United States, which looks unlikely at the moment, you're going to, I'm afraid, have these criminals protecting themselves rather than running the country.
Look,
you're talking about the deaths over in Iran or Iraq, but in Britain, I mean, this is how brutal the British were. They were actually getting volunteer soldiers from the British Army. The British Army. And they were testing these gases.
Thank you for that. We're unfortunately fresh out of time. I do apologize, Tony. Tony Gosling there, historian, investigative journalist. Sorry to cut you short there from Bristol. Christopher Halali, researcher and political analyst from Verschaire, Vermont. Thank you for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikava Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
And A startling revelation recently uncovered documents have exposed the Israeli regime's use of toxic chemicals in the 1970s to destroy Palestinian agricultural lands in the occupied West Bank of the River Jordan. The aim of this campaign was to pave the way for construction of new illegal Zionist settlements. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website BNN Network has covered this story and tells us more. According to newly revealed documents, the Israeli regime used toxic chemicals in Palestinian agricultural lands in the 1970s to destroy Palestinian crops with the aim of constructing new settlements in the occupied West Bank. The revelation was made in documents and records from a database run by the Jewish Settlements Archival Project, which deals with the inner workings of the Israeli cabinet and military during the early years of the settlement project. The documents, which revealed each step in the establishment of Gittit settlement in the occupied West Bank from planning to execution in 1972, said the first move was dispossessing residents of the nearby Palestinian village of their land under the false pretext of making it a military training zone, despite strong opposition from the Palestinian farmers. The document said, when the Palestinians insisted on cultivating the land, Israeli soldiers sabotaged their tools. Soldiers were later ordered to use vehicles to destroy the Palestinian crops. A radical solution was employed when this failed. A crop duster spread a toxic chemical. The substance was lethal for animals and dangerous for humans. The story briefly made headlines in 1972 when it was reported in foreign media, but the issue did not prevent the establishment of the Gittit settlement on land confiscated from Palestinian residents of the village of Agraba, which the military had poisoned. The document said the Israeli military's central command ordered the Jordan Valley Brigade in January of 1972 to ensure that no land is cultivated, including using vehicles to destroy existing agriculture. The Israeli regime's so-called custodian of absentee property was also reported to have summoned Palestinian village chiefs and leaders of family clans to remind them not to violate the instructions. The Palestinians had been threatened that otherwise their crops would be destroyed and that they would be prosecuted for unlicensed entry into a closed military zone. The newly made public documents also revealed that the Israeli military held a discussion in April of 1972 at its central command with the participation of officers, a representative of the settlements department at the Jewish Agency, and a custodian of absentee property, which was titled Spraying the Irregular Areas in the Tel Tar Sector. Tel Tar later became the Zionist settlement of Gittit. According to the document, the purpose of the meeting was to establish responsibility and schedule for the spraying. It also stated that for 3 days after the spraying, no one was to enter the area for fear of stomach poisoning. The document said animals were not allowed to enter for an additional week. The document further said the damage to Palestinians due to the spraying was estimated to amount to 12,000 to 14,000 Israeli pounds, equaling about $25,000. Other documents in the database revealed that the spraying of the area, which aimed to destroy the harvest, was carried out after the operation was approved by the Israeli regime's coordinator of activities in the territories. The vast majority of the international community considers such Zionist settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories as illegal. More than 600,000 occupying Zionist settlers live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Eastern Al-Quds. The United Nations Security Council has issued multiple resolutions condemning the Israeli regime's illegal settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinians insist on having the West Bank as part of a future independent state, with Eastern Al-Quds as its capital. The last round of Israeli-Palestinian talks collapsed in 2014. Among the major sticking points in those negotiations was the Tel Aviv regime's continued illegal settlement activities. The Bots news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Palestine has called upon the international community to impose sanctions and other punitive measures against the Israeli regime over its settlement construction policies in the occupied territories, saying countries should not simply suffice to written statements in this regard. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry stated recently that the Palestinian nation pays a heavy price every day as a result of settler violence and a surge in crimes being committed by Israeli troops and military against defenseless Palestinian civilians, their land, property and homes. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry added that the occupying Tel Aviv regime utilizes all of its capabilities to prevent the presence of Palestinians in Area C of the occupied West Bank, which constitutes about 61% of the territory and is under full Israeli military control, in order to build settlements as part of its creeping annexation of the occupied Palestinian territories, divide the West Bank, and kill any chance for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with Eastern Al-Quds as its capital. It said it has brought Israeli violations to international courts of law, most notably the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and contacted various United Nations officials and institutions. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also voiced its deep dissatisfaction over weak international reaction to the Israeli regime's annexation plans in the occupied West Bank and the construction of more settler units there. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry argued that such reactions indicate the exercise of double standards and the absence of a will to uphold international law and relevant United Nations resolutions, arguing that Israeli officials continue their illegal settlement construction policies in defiance of repeated international objections to such activities. The website MiddleEastMonitor.com has also covered the same story and tells us more. The foreign ministers of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, the PGCC, have strongly condemned the Israeli regime's plans to build new settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, urging international action to stop such plans. The foreign ministers of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries voiced their condemnation recently during the body's 156th ministerial meeting in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. The ministers rejected the regime's efforts to annex the settlements or impose its sovereignty over them, saying such efforts are against the resolutions adopted by international organizations, most notably the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334. The resolution, which was adopted in December of 2016, describes Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank and the city of Al-Quds as a flagrant violation under international law. The Persian Gulf Cooperation Council foreign ministers also urged the international community to mount pressure on the occupying regime to reverse its settlement policies. They reaffirmed their support for the sovereignty of the Palestinian people over the occupied territories, calling for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with East Al-Quds as its capital. In late February of this year, the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, called for an end to Israel's illegal settlement activities, stressing the illegality of all structures built in the occupied Palestinian territories. While addressing the United Nations Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, Antonio Guterres, UN Secretary General, said all settlement activities is illegal under international law and it must stop.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.